Welcome to the Jig Is Up podcast with your hosts, Darcy and Jason. The Jig Is Up is recorded on the traditional lands of the Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the lands of Treaty Six Nations. We aim to bring you new perspectives and open up conversations about Métis politics, culture, and current events, as well as stories that affect Indigenous from all over. If you like the show, or you don't, or if you want to send us suggestions for guests or topics to discuss on the show, feel free to email us at metispodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on all of the social media at Métis Podcast. Welcome back to The Jig Is Up. Today, Jason had the chance to sit down and have a fantastic conversation with Dr. Michael Bouchard. Dr. Bouchard is co-author of Songs Upon the River and Bois Brûlé, The Untold Story of the Métis of Western Quebec. Dr. Bouchard is currently working on the history of Canadienne and Métis in British Columbia and the Northwest Territories. I hope you enjoy the conversation. However, due to a technical issue, it was cut way too short. We will definitely be working to get Dr. Bouchard back on the show to continue this conversation.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Jig Is Up. I'm Jay, and today I have with me Dr. Michael Bouchard, professor of anthropology of UNBC and co-author of the new book, Bois Brûlé. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Well, thank you so much. It's a pleasure being here.
Yeah, glad to have you on. Hey, so we hear that you got a new book coming out. It's already out in French version, and it's coming out in English. Can you tell me a little bit about it?
Yeah, it's a sort of Le Bois Brûlé. So it's looking at, I guess, a community in Western Quebec, precisely in sort of the Maniwaki region, I guess, just to the north, of Ottawa. So
it's nice. So the book, does it primarily focus on just that community?
Yes. Looking at, in a sense, what is the historical evidence for the existence of a potential historic Métis community, I guess, in this region, and especially looking at how it was tied into the larger sort of continental process of, I guess, of the fur trade, of, in a sense, you have, I guess, the free traders, in a sense, of what they're called, I guess, the freemen, who set up, I guess, just outside the fur trading posts, who act or work as interpreters, as Hudson Bay Company employees or employees for the other fur trading posts, and then will often, in a sense, Indigenous wives, or Métis wives, will then, establish themselves and start being free traders, in their own right.
So for those who aren't familiar, whereabouts is this area geographically?
Yeah, so it's if you look through, the Ottawa River, which is the region which L'Outaouais, the French term, is just, you have, a number, of smaller rivers that flow into, in a sense, into the Ottawa. And what, you have, in a sense, the fur trade, in a sense, continued in this region well into, the 19th century. So it's part, on the interior side, of course, you also have, the Lake Timiskaming, in a sense, you have, the Mattawa River. So these are all part of one larger region, in a sense, where you had kind of a very active fur trade.
Nice. And so what time period are we looking at here in the course of your research?
Specifically, the main focus, in a sense, will be, the early part of the 19th century, so the early 1800s. Because something, in a sense, which is not necessarily known, is that in certain ways, in this region, was very much kind of what was still described by, let's say, the fur traders, the Hudson's Bay Company, the officials and others, was still part of the, quote-unquote, the Indian country. So here in this region, it is still a region, in a sense, where you will have, First Nations communities, you'll have, the fur trade. You have, of course, beginning of the, 1799, early 1800s, you have the beginning of the forestry industry in this region, but the fur trade will continue well into the 1840s and later. So we're specifically looking, of course, at this region before, in a sense, before you have, in a sense, the effective control where you have, in a sense, the incursion of more, the colonial and later, state authority in this region.
And so when you said that you were looking for historical evidences, what kind of things were you looking for?
Well, what are we doing since, I guess, looking at it from very much kind of a, I guess, an academic scientific perspective, which is to say, here we have to define, in a sense, the criteria of what would, in a sense, I guess, what would define, let's say, a historical Métis community from an anthropological, a sociological, a historical perspective. So we started, I guess, a starting point, I guess, research done, I guess, by, I guess, Raymer and Chartrain in Ontario, where they came up with, seven criteria to, in a sense, to see whether there would be, in a sense, would be, in a sense, the existence of, such a community. And we added, an eighth. So we were trying to come up with the criteria to say, if we can find these traits, then at least we have kind of, more kind of an objective, neutral criteria to judge, the evidence, that we will find.
So, I'm not sure if you know off the top of your head, what are those seven or eight criteria that you use to determine if the community was historically valid?
So for example, the first one, of course, you need some, of course, the indigenous ancestry, which is a given for any, Métis community. You have, in a sense, looking at a shared individual experience, in a sense, individuals who are, in a sense, raised, in a sense, in a bicultural kind of, context, in a sense, where they serve as intermediaries very often, in a sense, either as interpreters or intermediaries or traders between, let's say, First Nations communities and more, the trading companies, or later on, more the settler communities, recognition either from outsiders or, by themselves, looking at kind of, more the social structures, whether it be sort of kinship or, forms of, groupings, whether in small hamlets or outside of the fur trading post, and other forms, of kinship, and other ties, some political element, and that include, petitions, negotiations, demands put forward, for example, the Indian agents or the Department of Indian Affairs, some geographical elements, so looking at sort of the distributions of individuals, of families, the cultural elements, in a sense, looking for something distinctive. So it's not necessarily anything that is completely new, but even sometimes it's bringing together elements of, for example, various First Nations communities with Euro-Canadian society and making kind of a newer mixture, bringing in elements, from different places. And the eighth, which we added, was the use of, there were no recognized Métis ethnonyms, and that includes the term, of course, Beau Brûlé, but also Métis, in English, the historical, the half-breed, etc. So those were kind of the eight criteria, which we were kind of saying, will we find these in, among the evidence, of the historical, historical record?
And so a lot of those records, are they like church records? Are they oral traditions? Where did you guys go to, find these evidence?
I bet all of the above, in a sense. And I was quite fortunate. We had an exceptional team, in a sense. Guillaume Marcotte, in a sense, who had spent close to a decade, in a sense, doing research, in the Hudson's Bay Company, records, from this larger region. So he pretty much knew them inside and out, as well as looking at the records. Of course, you had the missionary activity. You have the Jesuits, but very large records, from the Oblates, in a sense. Also, when they're going into the records, they're often recording births and deaths and marriages, and often in little margins they'll make notes and noting whether somebody was a Métis, etc., as well as correspondence between, in essence, for example, let's say a priest and the Indian agent and the department, in a sense, where you have these letters going back and forth, in a sense, Guillaume, and Sébastien Mallette, in a sense, put in a great deal of time and effort into combing through these archival sources to look for these little bits and pieces that could then be tied together. Also, we had the advantage, there were also a number of government reports. So, for example, there's an expedition that is under the leadership of a British military, officer, Frederick Engel, who is charged with basically doing a tour of this larger region with the express purpose of saying, are there any potential agricultural lands here? So he is being sent out, and he is largely interested in saying, the geography, the geology of the region, describing the lakes and the soil and the forest, etc., because that was set his purpose. But along the way, he's also adding, in a sense, recording information that's almost, I guess, almost ethnographic. So he has some sort of the oral history that he then incorporates in his official report that's deposited both in English and French to the, I guess, to the legislature, the Assembly of, I guess, of Lower Canada. And you have a number of these other, sort of, I guess, more, I guess, firsthand reports of individuals who are talking about it. So we have this in terms of the historical, sort of archival historical record. But we also have, I guess, some more the oral history as well. So, for example, we found in the archives, a typed out oral history of, in a sense, of one woman who gives the story of her, in a sense, one of her great grandmothers, in a sense, I guess, and this is something, in a sense, that Guillaume, in a sense, I guess, and Sébastien have published on, and looking at, I guess, this Marie-Louise Riel and telling her history. So, in certain ways, it was a history that she had received from, I guess, through her family that she had typed out, and then that was kind of that was eventually ended up in the archives. As well, there had been, a large research project coming out of l'Université Saint-Boniface, in a sense, in which, Guillaume had also collaborated with, where you have, in a sense, Métis individuals across the country who were kind of interviewed and providing, in a sense, their recollections. So we were able to have access to these recordings, to this oral history, which was also incorporated into the book.
Nice. So it sounds like a fairly broad perspective on trying to establish a Métis community in that area. Now, typically, when we're talking about Métis identity out west, there's a very Red River-centric viewpoint. How is this, or how have you received any feedback on having this kind of perspective on saying that this is a historic community so far out east?
Well, I think this community, I think, in certain ways, what we forget is the spread of, the fur trade. So if we look in this particular region, there were a number, of the fur trade, outposts, posts, or trading posts, and in large part, it's not because necessarily the Hudson's Bay Company was making a lot of money on these outposts, in the early 1800s, but in certain ways, it was a means for them to block the movement of free traders farther north, in a sense, towards, the James Bay region, where there was a lot of profit, profit to be made, in the fur trade. So they were almost setting up these, the lost leaders, in the sense where in your Walmart, people say, we don't want to bring them in for these. But here's more kind of, this is our strategy to be able to see what's going on, to be able to keep an eye on these folk, and to make sure that we can keep, our profit farther north where we are really making the money. So you have, Hudson's Bay Company posts, and you have also occasionally the competing, trading companies that are also trying to set up shop, and they're trying to, in a sense, to control. So these individuals, because they are working with the Hudson's Bay Company, you have individuals who do come from the Red River, who do come from regions farther in the Northwest. Or so you have, in a sense, what we're trying to, quite interesting is kind of this network where individuals who are part of this fur trade, who are working at Hudson's Bay Company, they're often sent across the continent and back, and other individuals come from elsewhere moving in. So this idea of what it means to be Bois Brûlé and to be Métis is something that is being known and communicated and shared, and part of this larger socioeconomic, in a sense, worldview, in a sense, where we find the same processes, in a sense, where you do have these little communities of, let's say, the freemen who have the advantage because they can go, because you have Bytown that was being established, in the sense of what's now Ottawa, where they can go down quite easily, get trade goods, in the sense, go up to the communities, get the furs, bring them back, sell them in Bytown, get the money, and start the process all over again. So it was, a unique position where it was still relatively close to, let's say, to Bytown in order to get, in a sense, access to both money and trade goods and to be able to sell, in a sense, the furs. But at the same time, the communities, the First Nations communities, Algonquin, and Atikamekw and others were still close enough where it was possible for them to, in a sense, to serve as these intermediaries, as these free traders.
So given how volatile the whole conversation is regarding Métis, and a lot of the evidence is coming out for historic communities in the eastern provinces, how important do you view your book in contributing to that conversation?
Well, I think what we're, I guess what we're trying to do in a sense, and I think what was nice because of the great team we had in a sense, our strengths in a sense, and our strengths complemented, each other's strengths together. In a sense, what we were trying to do first and foremost was trying to say, first, we have to come up with a coherent, almost kind of, both in terms of theory, but also important in methodology, saying, if you want to do it, this is how it has been done, let's say, in Ontario and other locations, you want to have, in a sense, an evidence-based, discussion, where we're saying, here are, in a sense, the criteria, this is how we will, in a sense, examine, the evidence, this is what we are looking for, and then we will be able to see, in a sense, to bring forward the evidence to come forward and say, here, this is the case that can be made, and because of the evidence that was found, evidence that was largely, perhaps overlooked or wasn't necessarily even examined, in the historical record, and trying to piece it together, saying, here is all the little bits and pieces of the evidence to show that, in the sense that there was a historical community, and also think certain ways, and this is perhaps, for us, the Dacian strength was trying to come up again to look at, in certain ways, from the theoretical perspective, and even trying to define how individual and sort of the community is not based simply on an individual, and individuals and families can change over time, and we see this even in the Paoli case. In the case of the Paoli, the family over time, at some time, in a sense, they had been accepted, incorporated into, the First Nations Indigenous community, and the reserves, and they left, and so there was never kind of we can look simply at a snapshot, a given moment, to say, see, they were no longer here, or see, the community disappeared. You have to look at it from the bigger perspective, and keep in mind that these communities will often exist, even though individuals may move in, may move out, and over generations there can be shifts in terms of individuals. And there's nothing wrong with that. In certain ways, there's some individuals who historically might have been part of, this community in the 1840s. Their children, grandchildren, great-grandchildren were fully incorporated, in the Algonquin community, the Anishinaabe community, of Maniwaki. And that's perfectly fine. But that doesn't necessarily deny either that other individuals who might be distantly related, who were not incorporated and who, in a sense, still see themselves as being rightfully Métis. So I think, and the same thing can be said in the West as well. So we have to look at both the complexity of social relations, in the sense that social life is never easy, even in the present, in the sense when people are trying to define themselves and being defined by the outside, etc. And we must, in a sense, take a very, very coherent, nuanced look when we're looking at the shifting over a century plus, of history in terms, of family histories and, and lived realities.
I think that's, you hit on a very good point there. We've seen a lot of things that we want to create very clear-cut, arbitrary lines between First Nations communities, Métis communities, and, customs, traditions, all kinds of things that we use to create these lines. But when you're on the ground and you're in community, and a lot of times these lines are not that arbitrary.
Exactly. And in certain ways, what usually happens, since it's the nationalist narratives that want to create these clear-cut, perfect lines saying, yes, we have always been Métis, and the line once drawn can never be bridged. But very often such narratives don't rest necessarily account for the historical reality or even contemporary reality.
Yeah, and we see a lot of that same information reflected in a lot of the script reports that come out of northern Alberta and Saskatchewan, where there was a lot tighter grouping between Métis communities and First Nations communities as far as living and tradition and those kinds of things. So your book is out in French already. How's it been going? How's the book been received so far?
Oh, well, I must apologize. Sometimes you're cutting in and coming out. I think you asked how the book was received so far. The important thing, since we had kind of the honor and the pleasure of going back to the community to present the books. And since we had there were probably close to at least 100 people, out in Maniwaki who came out, individuals often buying two or three copies of the books, and I think they provide some very nice, favorable, comments, because in certain ways, individuals might have known bits and pieces of the history, so very often individuals, enjoyed reading to see these other pieces, being tied together. So in the sense that it allowed there to put their family's history and their oral tradition into this, I guess, the history that we're presenting in the sense, I guess, in the book, in the sense that was done, I guess, within a collaborative way, in a sense, I guess, with the community.
Yeah, it's always very interesting when you're doing historical research and you present that to the local community. It's a very different feel, I guess, than if you're a person like me reading the book from the outside of that community.
Oh, so the reaction from the outside. Well, I think as can be expected, there are two very, at least a minimum of two, maybe more different camps. In the sense, of course, those who are in the other camp, in a sense, looking at it quite critically, and of course bringing forward their critique. And so, and what we're seeing, of course, there's not only the two different kind of almost kind of quasi-ideological camps, but also in terms of the linguistic camps as well. Because this is one, the purpose of our, what we're seeking with our book, in the sense, and we're quite fortunate. The French version came out with Les Presses de l'Université Laval, last spring, and the English version will be coming out, with UBC Press, this April. So we will have within less than a year, we will have in a sense, a French version and an English version. With the English version, it's somewhat of an enhanced version because we had a separate peer review and one to address some of the comments brought forward in a sense by the referee. We added some additional content in the sense of clarification, more discussion of other authors. And I think so. We certainly expanded. So I think what we're looking for the English version coming out in English, because then people will be able to hopefully read it themselves. In other words, instead of being said by somebody, say, this is what was said in the English and the French book, the people will be able to go directly to the English book and read it for themselves and to look at the evidence. So we were consciously trying to make sure that we were reaching across, the linguistic divide, making sure that people will be able to read the book in a sense both in French and in English, and therefore, like it, dislike it, we don't care, but all we're asked for at least is they read it, look at the evidence presented, and then talk about what's actually in the book as opposed to what is projected onto the book.
I think that's the harder challenge when you put forward any new information regarding Métis identity, is the perception over the reality, and we've had such a very strong narrative coming from a West-centric viewpoint that there aren't any real historic Métis communities, west of Manitoba, really. So it'll be interesting to see, from my perspective, because we're strong proponents of the Eastern Métis identity, to see how the book is received once it comes out in English.
And even I think certain ways, there is again the projection of this idealized identity in the past. But certain people are really people, and they have to deal with their everyday reality, and they have to sometimes mask their identity. Sometimes they will, in a sense, say, no, we're not quite that. But there's the wonderful research done, for example, in Montana, where the Métis, where the Americans were kind of hinting, well, those Métis are actually should be on the other side. They should be in the British and later Canadian territory. So of course, families were kind of worried that they would be deported, that they would be forced out of their homes. So under those circumstances, individuals would say, well, no, we're not really Métis, we're just French-Canadian, eh? So that they would kind of place, and I guess in order to protect and sense their livelihood and sense their, to make sure that they're found. So I think this idealization, perhaps, of certain regions to say, we were completely always Métis and we're always defined as Métis. Individuals will, because of circumstances, because of, whether discrimination or dangers or other fears, will often, in a sense, won't necessarily always say I was X, Y, or Z. They will do what they can do, what is best, what they think is best at a given, given moment. So I think we kind of overlook that. I think perhaps there's more shared than was often, acknowledged.
Yeah, that's always been true. I think of a lot of Indigenous communities across the board as people at the end of the day still had to feed their families, put a roof over their head. And so identity and your, Indigenous background lots of time paid the price for trying to survive.
Exactly. And even we see it, for example, one of my colleagues, in a sense, doing research, let's say, here in the University of British Columbia, you had a case historically, you had two brothers, in a sense, who were Lake Lieutenay. one took status and the other did not, because the other was in business. And he knew if he took status that all of a sudden he would be quite compromised. He'd be under the authority of the Indian agent, et cetera. So his business, I guess, activity would pretty much come to a stop. So I think would, let's say, the descendants of this hypothetical individual not be Fleitley 10A because, I guess, of a decision taken? Well, I would say, no, I don't, right? And I presume many of the descendants may have, in a sense, reacquired, I guess, status. But nonetheless, we have to be, in a sense, I think you're right, in a sense, that individuals have to feed their families. And often they will do what is best, given whether the laws or whether the structures or whether the larger social, I guess, social cultural forces at play will try to do what is best at a given moment.
I want to thank Dr. Bouchard for being part of the Jig Is Up. And I know Jason and I are both very excited to get him back on the show and continue that conversation. So we're looking forward to that. I wanted to tell you a little bit about something new that we're going to try to do this week. And it's a live show where we actually have callers to the show. So it's going to be more like a radio show. Now, if you want to be part of the show or if you want to listen live, there's a couple things you need to do. One, you need to get the free Podbean app onto your device. So go to your app store and download that. And it's Podbean, just like coffee bean. And then on the app, you need to set up a free account. And it doesn't require any credit cards or nothing. It's just basically name, you know, that kind of thing. And then be sure to search for The Jig Is Up and follow us on the Podbean app. What that allows you to do is it'll allow you to listen live during the show. But it'll also allow you to send us a request to be a caller in on the show. And we'll have people in queue, hopefully. And, you know, we'll get everybody on if we can. So we're going to set up the live show for this coming Friday, February 14th at 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. So anybody that's got the app anywhere in Canada or anywhere in the world can be a caller in on the show. So, you know, we're not limited to geography here or, you know, cell phone charges or anything like that. It's all based on Wi-Fi and it's all through the app. So make sure you download that Podbean app, set up your account, follow us, and you can take part of the live show on February 14th. At 6 p.m. Mountain Standard Time. But for now, I really want to thank again Dr. Bouchard for being on the show. I want to thank Jason for taking the time to sit down and have a conversation with him. And until next time, the jig is up.